Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. Here on GCN, we strive to expose the beguiling and destructive myths that are associated with religion and with politics, with patriotism and with the media, with military and with economic schemes. If you listen, your eyes may be open and you may ultimately change your mind towards many of these things. Today, during our first hour, we're going to engage God on His terms by way of His invitations to meet and through His always dependable Torah teaching, so that with His guidance, you'll be able to replace your religion with reason and find salvation in the process. And during the second hour, we're going to welcome IQ Al-Rasuli back to the program, and we're going to discuss many of the intersections between the Quran and the Torah of Yahweh and determine if Allah is really God. Our phone number for those who would like to question, criticize, affirm anything that is said over the next 2 hours is 877-376-45. Today is Bukurim. Happy Bukurim. It is, if there ever was a birthday, today is our birthday. It is a birthday worth celebrating. It is the third of the 3 days that comprise the beginning of the year Mikre from Yah's perspective, Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. As we have shared, the Pesach is all about resolving the issue of our mortality. It is the doorway to life, and Matzah is responsible for purifying us, for cleansing us, for removing the fungus of sin, which is referred to as yeast, from our souls so that we are perfected and can enter God's presence. And Bukurim is the summation of those events, which enables God to adopt us into His covenant family. And so today we are celebrating our birthday, Bukurim, which means firstborn children. Children born into the first family. Yesterday, as we were concluding our thoughts on Pesach and Matzah, we came to a passage which certainly indicated two things. One is that God views Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim as a single event. Whether He refers to it as Pesach or as Matzah, sometimes as even Bukurim, which would be the harvest aspect of these 3 days, our souls are collected, gathered in by God. And He said yesterday, in a statement in Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness, the individual who himself is clean but does not exist on the way, when he abandons and fails to act upon Pesach, that soul will be cut off and separated from her family. And that is because Yahweh's offering to approach was not present and not brought near him at the appointed time. That individual will bear his guilt. Now, it's interesting. This is suggesting that the opposite of what Christianity proclaims is an individual who is actually clean. That would be morally pure. Now, according to Christianity, it isn't possible to be morally pure. But they're saying, okay, let's just take your hypothetical individual that is morally pure. But that individual does not avail themselves of the invitations to be called out and meet with God, the first of which is Pesach, followed by Matzah and Bukurim. God is saying, you know, I don't care how morally pure an individual thinks they are. I have prepared a path from man's world to mine. The first step of that path is the doorway named Passover. If you do not participate in Passover, if you don't answer my invitation to attend Passover, then you will be cut off and separated from her family. Her family is the set-apart spirit's family, which is the covenant family. Covenant is also a feminine noun in Hebrew. And therefore, you will be unable to approach God. And as a result of not following these instructions, that individual will bear his or her guilt. The same concept is repeated in Kata, Leviticus 23:29, where we read, "Because any soul who does not respond to the summons and answer on this life-sustaining and corporeal and empowering, this essential day," and he's now speaking of Yom Kippurim, "these shall be cut off and separated from the family." to be separated from the covenant family means one of two things has occurred. Either your soul no longer exists, which under which case it is not included in the covenant family, or your soul does exist, but it is separated under Sheol because you have misled others, in which case you are also excluded from the family. So God is very serious about this. This is not a issue where you can say, well, you know, I really feel good at Monday, Thursday, and Good Friday, and at Easter Sunday services. So since it makes me feel good, and since I think I'm going to honor God, and since that God knows my heart, that I'm sure that he's not upset and that he'll embrace me anyway. Yeah, that's not true. If you choose to attend an Easter service, your soul is all but lost. Now, that doesn't mean that sometime in your life you will recant that you will regret having done that, and that you will no longer attend any additional church services, much less an Easter service, and that you will start attending God's seven annual meetings. Because so long as you are attending church and going to Easter services, your soul is as good as dead. It has no chance of salvation. You aren't just not pleasing God, you are angering him. Easter is a purely pagan, purely Babylonian festival. It is even named after the Babylonian goddess. It has no correlation of any kind with anything Yahusha did, said, or that Yahweh did or said. It is a dead end. And so God is saying, if you want to be part of his family, that these days, whether it be Pesach, Matzah, Yom Kippurim, that on these days he has invited you to meet with him. If you've chosen not to do so, you will be cut off and excluded from his family, which either means your soul will cease to exist if you have simply been beguiled and misled, played for a fool, or your soul will be eternally incarcerated in Sheol if you have led others astray. The message is convincing. It is consistent. Those who choose not to answer Yahweh's summons and attend his annual called-out assemblies will be separated. They will be excommunicated. They'll be banished and eliminated from his family and his presence. Their souls will cease to exist at the end of their mortal lives. Therefore, the fate of those who celebrate New Year's Day, St. Valentine's Day, Lent, Palm Sunday, the Last Supper by way of the Eucharist and Communion, Good Friday, Easter Sunday, Halloween, and Christmas, instead of Yahweh's seven Mikra, the decision regarding the fate of their soul has been articulated. Now, for those that, oh, that's not fair, you can't judge me just because you don't think that I should go to church on a Sunday, that's unfair. You ought not be so judgmental. Well, I'm just telling you what God said. You don't like it? Take up the argument with him. See if you can convince him to accept Easter as a substitute for Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. See if you can get him to say, oh, you know, when I said that you either attend Pesach, you either attend Matzah, or your soul will be eliminated and will be estranged, that I was really lying. See if you can get him to recant his testimony. Take it up with him. Good luck. You'll need it. These statements are more than adequate alone, to demonstrate that the lone, narrow, restrictive, and unpopular path that God has prepared in this life for us to extend our lives and live with him is predicated upon the Mikra, and that all other paths lead to the death and destruction of one soul. But when these passages are considered alongside Yahusha's teaching on the Mount, all hope of the Christian solution vanishes. It is there and then that Yahusha was translated saying, do not assume, do not suppose, do not acknowledge, do not believe, if that's your preference, that I have come to weaken, to dismantle, to invalidate, or to abolish, to tear down, to dissolve, to put an end to do away with or annul, the Torah or the prophets. I have not come to do away, to invalidate or abolish them, but instead to completely fulfill them. Please note, however, that Yahweh did not say that he was going to kill the people that do not attend his meetings. God did not say that he was going to torture anyone in hell that didn't accept his plan, who didn't walk along his path. From his perspective, every soul is free to live their life and to make their own choices. All Yahweh has said is that when the life of a soul who retains sin because they ignored his provision for sin is over, that their soul will cease to exist and or it will be estranged from his family. That's it. It's a simple choice. Those are the consequences. Turning to Shemoth, the names, Exodus 12:16, we read, on the first day, there is a set-apart invitation to meet and to be called out. And on the seventh day, there is a set-apart invitation to be called out for you. Do not do any of the service of the heavenly representative, the Malacha, during them. We covered this from Kara rather than Shemoth yesterday. So God is saying that the first and the seventh day is a mikra. Now, the first day, really, of unleavened bread is actually Pesach. And, of course, the fact that there are two of these tells us that there are 2 days that are very special to God relative to the solution that he is providing. The first and the seventh. Seven, because it is his formula. There are 7 of these mikra. God wants to reinforce that his formula for perfection is based upon 7. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Matt on the phone calling in from Wisconsin. I understand that Matt has a question on, we'll put this in quotes, the Last Supper. Hello, Matt. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Yada. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I realize that Last Supper is horrible and wrong, and I kind of got lost in what I wanted to ask about. It wasn't so much about that. I understand what's wrong with that. My specific question is, when you go into, and I can't remember the Hebrew name, but Luke, the book of Luke, I notice in the text there that when the Messiah talks about the covenant, he uses the word new. And based on everything I've been learning and understanding, would that use of the word new, would that possibly be some religious editing that happened somewhere along the way? I
sure,
see so much argument out there that he used that, and so therefore there's a new covenant.
Yeah.
And I think there's more that suggests that was edited in. Is that correct?
Well, first of all, you are right. There's no such thing as a Last Supper. The very fact that that it's thought of in that vein precludes Christians from understanding the event.
Right, I agree, totally.
Yeah, Yahusha was celebrating Passover.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the context of Passover, Yahusha's fulfillment of the Torah's promise certainly do reaffirm and they do restore the covenant for those who have been estranged from it. So that would be a reasonable conclusion. However, the second point I wanted to make is that Luke does not have a Hebrew name. Lucas is a Latin name. It means it's based on the Latin word for light.
Okay.
Luke was Paul's pal.
Right.
Towards the end, it becomes fairly obvious that Luke figured out that Paul was a fraud And he does present information in Acts on Paul that is certainly overwhelmingly critical of Paul. So there is, and even Paul's own letters, Paul says, everybody has abandoned me. So that would also include Luke. But we have to be careful with Luke because unlike Yaokanan and Matan Yah, Luke was not an eyewitness. Everything that Luke has to say, even if you had an original copy of Luke, it would be hearsay. Luke simply had a friend who wanted to know what happened. And so since he had spent a limited amount of time around some of the people who were either eyewitnesses or who had heard the eyewitnesses, he made an attempt to record what had happened. Now, that means that to the degree that he talked to people who were there and talked to people who talked to people who were there, it has some merit, but it is not an eyewitness account. Luke was not celebrating Pesach with Yahusha. The other issue that you have is that there are two presentations of what happened that night and what was said that night. One has renewed prior to covenant. The other does not. So now you have a problem. If you are a Christian, you're going to base your Christianity on this. One time, there is no mention of renewed or new, and the other time, there is.
Are you saying that they're both occurring in the same book, or if you compare that
to the other accounts? Yes, there are two accounts. Yeah. There are two accounts of what was said that night, and one of the two mentions has the word renew. And the other one does not.
Okay.
So what we know for certain is that we have a conflict. And conflicts in testimony as important as this tell us that we can't trust the source, either source. I mean, at this point, one of the two sources is not telling us the whole truth. And we have absolutely no way whatsoever to know which one is misrepresenting the information. Now, you have another issue, which is we don't have tremendously old copies of these books. And the copies that we do have that predate Constantine differ so radically from our copies that are the Nestle Allen, which is the current perceived gold standard, if you will, for the so-called Christian New Testament, and that we know that there are over 300,000 known variations between the oldest manuscripts and the Textus Receptus and now even the Nestle Allen. If there are 300,000 known variances between these things, and there's only 182,000 words on average in them, doesn't that tell you that this evidence is highly, highly suspect and almost completely unreliable? Now we'll speak, Matt, if you'll hold on after the break, I'll add one more. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Mists. We're on the phone with Matt, who's called in from Wisconsin. And Matt, I was not completely correct with you and my answer thus far to your question. I was right when I told you that it is true that in Luke, who we know was not an eyewitness, that it does mention a new or renewing of the covenant. There in Luke 22:20 it says, "And in the same way he took the cup, and after they had eaten, saying, this cup which is poured out for you is the," in the New American Standard says, "new covenant in my blood." Now, in the concept of what Passover represents, it is in fact Yahweh restoring and renewing his covenant through this very act. But I told you correctly that in another presentation of what was said, that there was no mention of renewed or new before covenant. And that is true, not the whole truth. Let me read to you what was written by Mark. Mark was also not an eyewitness. Mark was Peter's translator for part of Peter's ministry. Shimon Kefesh, to be more exact.
Mm-hmm.
Not Mark, but the real name of Peter was Shimon Kefesh. It means he listens.
Right.
And Kefesh means rock in Aramaic. This is now from the 14th chapter, the 24th statement in that chapter. And he, this would be Yahusha, said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is shed on behalf of many." The covenant. So far, I have told you is accurate, that there are conflicting testimony as to whether or not he said new or not. Now, that would tell you that, yes, if you have two, you have no way of knowing which one is accurate. However, there was an eyewitness there, wasn't there?
Yes.
A fellow that was indeed an eyewitness, and he wrote a book. That would be Matanyahu. Matanyahu, which means Yah gives, Yahweh gives, began his discussion of this same dinner in the 26th chapter, the 19th verse. So this is the place where I up to this point, I've told you the truth. I didn't tell you the whole truth. This conversation, I didn't recall whether or not Matanyahu actually recorded this particular statement, because Matanyahu was really more interested in other things pertaining to this meal, because there were, you know, celebrating Passover was just an ordinary part of their lives. I mean, they had always celebrated Passover. This was the third Passover. They were even celebrating with Yahusha, was something they always did. Part of the fabric of their lives was to have Passover. But anyway, this begins at the 19th verse of the 26th chapter, and it begins, "And the disciples did as Yahusha had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. And now when the evening had come, he was reclining at the table with the 12 disciples." All right? So now he goes into the story of, now one of you is going to betray me. But he does record this very statement. In the 28th verse, it reads, now this is the only eyewitness of the three so far. He says, "For this is my blood of the covenant, which is to be shed on behalf of many for the forgiveness of sins." So you've got three accounts, two of which agree, one of which is by an eyewitness, and the one from the eyewitness agrees is in the majority. So if you were a rational person and you've got a hearsay statement that adds a word that isn't in the other two accounts, and one of the other two accounts that doesn't have the word is from an eyewitness who was there, which one would you say is true? All three can't be true. Two of them can be true, or two of them can be false.
Go with the eyewitness, obviously.
Obviously. That's how I'd respond to your... those who are suggesting otherwise. Now,
okay.
One other last thought. There is I made a statement that I was going to play off of. It wasn't entirely true. When I said, you know, if there were just these two statements, and now we know there's a third and it was an eyewitness, but if there were just these two statements, we would otherwise have no way of knowing whether the hearsay testimony included in Mark or the hearsay testimony included in Luke was the one that was accurate, because they both can't be telling the truth. There is a way. It's the same way that God tells us that we should test everything. You go back to Devarim 13 and Devarim 18, that would be Deuteronomy 13 mm-hmm. and 18. God provides the test that we apply to know whether or not what we're hearing is true. What he says is that if what you hear or read isn't completely consistent with he has said, and if it does not come true, then you are to view that witness as a false witness. Now, God defines the renewing of his covenant in only one place, and every Christian in the world knows it. It's in Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu 31:31. That's where right. he defines and introduces the concept of a renewed covenant. So to find out whether or not Luke's testimony is right and the other two is wrong, we have to determine whether or not the promise of a New Testament occurred at the time of Yahusha's sacrifice on Passover. And if you recall, in the presentation of the renewing of the covenant, God said that those who would be affected by it would be reconciled by it and affirmed and renewed by it would be Yehudim and Yisrael.
Right.
Were Yehudim and Yisrael reunited with Yahweh as a result of this, from the Christian perspective, was it the Gentile church?
From the Christian perspective?
Yeah.
Well, the Christian perspective will say it was with them.
Okay, the Gentile church. But the promise here is for
them, right.
Yisrael and Yehuda. And we don't see Yisrael and Yehuda reconciled with Yahweh, do we? Not even
right now.
In fact, it wouldn't be long after this event that they were banished. They were driven from their land, the opposite of reconciliation. They were estranged. So this event and subsequent events left to their estrangement around the world, which would be the opposite of reconciliation. He also said that as a result of the renewing of his covenant, that his Torah would be written inside of all of us.
Right.
Do you have a copy of the Torah written inside of you?
Does any
Christian have a copy of the Torah written inside of them? They hate the Torah.
Right.
So Paul's testimony is erroneous, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely.
So if Paul's testimony is erroneous by using the test that Yahweh provided, what is Luke? A false witness in this regard. That doesn't mean that everything you say that Luke said is false, but because Luke, it's interesting, Luke does not claim to speak for God. He does not claim that he is uttering inspired utterances. If you view Luke as that, which would be false, if you view Luke as that, or if Luke actually said that, then we would have to condemn Luke as a false prophet. And God said that the witness of a false prophet is deadly.
Sure.
So, but Luke never made that claim. Does Luke ever say, I am speaking inspired utterances, I am writing in the name of God, what I am telling you was divinely inspired? Does he ever say that?
I don't believe he ever did.
No, he never does. So Luke is not, we can't convict Luke of being a false prophet, but we can use God's testimony to determine that what he wrote here, should he actually have written this,
mm-hmm.
was false.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I had just, the reason I had asked this is, you know, if you encounter Christians and you talk to them about mm-hmm. it being only one covenant, this is where they land every time. And
I find them going more often to Jeremiah 31:31, because it says that the renewing of the covenant will be different than the existing covenant. They don't go any further than that.
But that's an easy one to argue back on. The one in Luke, I'm having a tougher time making.
Yeah, it takes you a little more time. What you need to do on Luke is say, you know, there was Luke was not an eyewitness, and yet his testimony against the other non-eyewitness, Mark, is inconsistent. There was one eyewitness, and the eyewitness disagrees with Luke. The one eyewitness was Matthew, and he agrees with Mark that the word new was not used.
Sure. Well, and I've even noticed, and again, this comes from my experiences and background, unfortunately, that it's Luke that they will cite in a Catholic church.
Mm-hmm.
And for their Eucharist. And again, I understand
right.
everything that's
yep.
wrong with that, but I just,
yep.
I happen to one day pick up on, okay, that's the one that they cite.
That is correct.
That word new is there.
Yep. You know, what happens?
How did that word new get there?
Yeah. What happens when people take things out of context and they don't consider them in the context of the whole? Always the same thing. that if you don't, the moment you take this out of the context of Passover, you have no hope of understanding even what was being done or said. And every one of your Christians will take it out of the context of Passover. That's why you began by using a reference which you knew was wrong, but Christians don't know it's wrong, of the Last Supper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so the moment you start there, you're gone. And then second, there are two eyewitness accounts and two hearsay accounts of the words and deeds of Yahusha. Plus, of course, there's the eyewitness accounts that exist in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
Right.
And so when there is a disagreement between a hearsay account and a eyewitness account, and when the eyewitness account agrees with the prophetic account and disagrees with the hearsay account, you have to be a nut. I mean, you'd have to be a nincompoop to say, I'm going to side with the hearsay account over the prophetic testimony of Yahweh in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms regarding, for example, the renewing of his covenant, and with the eyewitness account. I'm instead going to take the testimony that was hearsay that wouldn't even be allowed in a court of law.
Okay.
We'll be back to Shattering Myths after a moment. We'll have a conversation with Larry at that time. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're here with Larry and with Matt. It is fascinating to me how desperate people will be. You've got Yahweh telling us in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and particularly right in the heart of the book that he wrote to Goyim. It is the one book. I mean, the Torah was, there's one Torah for Yehudim and for Goyim, and so it's written for all of us. But there's one book where Yahweh, right at the beginning, says that, you know, the intended audience for this book is Goyim. And that's Yirmiyahu. And he speaks in that book about the renewing of the covenant. He associates directly with the Yom Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliations. He tells us that the audience is Yisrael and Yehudim. And he tells us that the basis of this renewal is going to be writing his Torah inside of us. And yet Christians are going to cite a hearsay witness, a non-witness, just a hearsay report, over two reports that disagree with it, one of which was by an eyewitness, and they're going to take the lone dissenting view over the Word of God himself and over the eyewitness. And they think that is a reasoned response. It's pretty pathetic. I'm sure, Larry, that you encounter this a lot because you like to stir up the hornet's nest.
Well, what I would say is this, you know, can anybody be right if they contradict the words of Yahweh himself? Is it possible?
No.
Okay. And Zechariah says this, behold, Yahweh's day of return and restoration is coming. Restoration of what? Of the covenant.
Right. Right. And he explains it in Yirmiyahu how he's restoring the covenant, and he's restoring it with its original audience.
We can find it 20 places, but I mean that's just a very simple. Okay, he's coming his day of restoration. He pinpoints, by the way, in Zechariah, he pinpoints very clearly the moment that the covenant is renewed. He says, I will return and harvest this one third in the fire. I will refine them as one refines silver and test them as one does gold. They will summon my personal and proper name, and I will answer them. And they will say, and I will say, you are my people, and they will say, Yahweh is our Elohim. Now that's Zechariah 13:9.
Now it's interesting. Okay, now there's something interesting. There's more to Zechariah. I just thought about this. It's a perfect statement. The Christian claim, based upon the errant testimony of Luke, and Luke wasn't trying to make a mistake, and maybe even Luke didn't make a mistake, and it was added later. But doesn't in Zechariah Yahweh say that they will look upon me whom they have pierced?
Yeah, he says, that's right there in Zechariah 12:10. So they will look upon me whom by association they pierced, mourning as one wails for an only begotten son, grieving bitterly over him as one suffers anguish over a firstborn.
Okay, so let's put the pieces together. what day and of the seven festival feasts that that Yahweh has either fulfilled or has not yet fulfilled, on which day was he pierced?
Pierced, he was in Pesach.
Oh yeah, Pesach, right? Passover. Pesach, and so,
yeah.
And so the account in the upper room was a Passover celebration where Yahusha said, well, when you, the bread and the wine associated with my sacrifice on this day, I want you to remember me in conjunction with Passover. So, if Passover was the time that the covenant is being renewed, and, Yahusha says, wait a minute, you pierced, you're looking at me whom you pierced, and I didn't renew it then, but I'm renewing it now, which is on Yom Kippurim. Is there any possibility that the covenant was renewed on Pesach?
No, not a chance. No, not a small chance.
Yeah, because he said, listen, you pierced me in the past. I'm returning now. I'm renewing and restoring my covenant with you now, and that means that I didn't do it back there on Pesach.
Right. Of course he didn't.
So it's all you have to do is put the pieces together. God gives us the information, and you're correct.
Well, you would have to think about it. And then you'd have to question a ridiculous belief system that you had been taught out of the traditions of men.
Right.
And that's what you have to do. It doesn't take a lot of thought to do what we just did, does it?
No. If you simply put Yirmiyahu and Zechariah, Zechariah means remember Yah, Yirmiyahu means Yahweh uplifts. If you put them together with the testimony that you find from the lone eyewitness to the scene who wrote about it, Matanyah, it is perfectly clear exactly what happened, what the bread and the wine were symbolizing as it relates to Passover and unleavened bread, and when the covenant would be renewed, which is on the Day of Reconciliations, Yom Kippurim. This is Shattering Myths. We'll be back in a moment.